You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the broadcast today, the budget battles are back, snow as a marketable commodity, and the woman in charge of diversity at Facebook. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of KQED in San Francisco, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 29th of January today. And what I need you to do for me now is cast your mind back to the budget battles of yesteryear. All right, just a couple of yesteryears, actually. 2 years ago, and a little thing that came to have a life and a buzzword all of its own, the sequestration, we called it. Those across-the-board budget cuts that pretty much everybody agreed were stupid, but which happened anyway. Against that backdrop, we come now to this coming Monday when President Obama will officially reveal his budget plan for this year. The White House is going to call on Congress to end said sequestration. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer starts us off with where all those budget cuts have gotten us.
So since sequestration started in 2013, the budget deficit did get smaller, but it's still hundreds of billions of dollars. Sequestration just took a nibble out of it.
Sequestration has been saving us between $60 and $90 billion per year.
Mark Goldwine is Senior Policy Director of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Now, that's not enough to solve our debt problems, but it's not nothing either.
Congress eased some of sequestration's sting during the past two budget years, but it's still bit hard enough for people like Emily Holubowicz to notice. She heads the Coalition for Health Funding. She says under sequestration, Congress sacrificed planning for medical emergencies like Ebola.
They look and say, well, where can we cut? We don't need to invest in planning and preparedness. And it's when you let your guard down that we see something else happen.
At the Pentagon, sequestration forced cuts in training. It meant deferred maintenance, and it limited pay increases. Jim Savage teaches politics and public policy at the University of Virginia. He doesn't think much of sequestration.
When you rely upon across-the-board measures, it's usually the sign of weak management. It's also another way of sort of avoiding political accountability to make the hard choices.
But Savage says sequestration will force some hard choices on Congress this year. It's already cut the low-hanging fruit. There aren't many spending cuts left that everyone can agree on. And remember, sequestration is scheduled to last until 2021. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A change came to the Golden Arches late yesterday afternoon, a change that consumers may, or I suppose may not, feel in the months and years to come. Donald Thompson, the CEO of McDonald's, stepped down after just 2 years on the job. Two, it must be said, terrifically difficult and not all that successful years for the company. Marketplace's Annie Baxter answers the now what do they do question.
Sales at McDonald's roughly 14,000 U.S. restaurants are slumping. Sarah Senator covers restaurants at the research and brokerage firm Sanford C. Bernstein. She says part of the problem is more wholesome competitors where
the food is better quality. Tends to be higher priced as a result. There's a real emphasis on things like provenance, sourcing, local farms.
Think Chipotle. But Mickey D's also faces image problems with customers who just want a good price. Carlin Norfleet Taylor at Fitch Ratings says that's another area where competitors are winning.
Whether it's Burger King with 2 for $5, mix and match, choose what you want, just being a lot more creative than we're seeing with McDonald's, I think, on the promotional front.
The incoming chief executive, Steve Easterbrook, is currently chief brand officer. He's spearheaded efforts to boost marketing and let diners customize their orders more easily. And he previously led a successful turnaround in McDonald's United Kingdom business. He helped dispel worries about food quality and even took part in a televised debate about the fast food industry.
The average customer comes into McDonald's 3 to 4 times a month. And I am absolutely convinced that that can fit in very comfortably into a balanced diet.
Still, Sarah Senator does wonder why the chief brand officer has a brand crisis to face when he takes over the corner office.
I think it is a fair question when, there does seem to be an issue with brand resonance.
Senator says she'll be eager to hear Easterbrook's turnaround plan when he takes over March 1st. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Investors were loving that McDonald's news. Shares up 5% today. The rest of the markets did very nicely, too. Thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the defining characteristics of the Affordable Care Act, maybe the defining characteristic actually, was that everybody has to get health insurance. And if you don't, you have to pay a penalty that the law says and the Supreme Court agreed was actually a tax. Like it or not, tax season is right around the corner, and there are some new numbers out from the Treasury Department about exactly how many people are going to have to pay that tax. 2 to 4% of taxpayers, they're saying. Not huge percentage-wise. But still, that is somewhere between 3 and 6 million households that will have to pay up, or what exactly? Stan Alcorn explains.
The penalty for not having health insurance is $95, or 1% of your income, whichever's higher. But as health economist Linda Blumberg points out, some groups are exempt.
People who are undocumented, people who are incarcerated, Native Americans, there are some religious exemptions.
And the biggest exempt group? Those too poor to file taxes. Subtract all those, and you're left with the estimated 3 to 6 million middle-income uninsured households who owe a, quote, shared responsibility payment.
It will show up on your tax bill, and, you know, folks are expected to pay for it.
It is, after all, how Obamacare is supposed to nudge everyone into getting health insurance. Larry Levitt at the Kaiser Family Foundation says there are carrots, like subsidies for those who can't afford insurance, and
this penalty is the stick.
But it is not a very pointy stick.
The IRS has very limited enforcement power to make you pay the health insurance penalty.
The law prevents the IRS from putting a lien on your house or garnishing your wages like it could if you were an ordinary tax evader. All it can really do is garnish your tax refunds.
Certainly no one's going to jail.
And on top of those legal limits, healthcare attorney Travis Jackson says the IRS has been facing steep budget cuts.
The commissioner of the IRS had made statements that already they're going to have to do less with less, and this is probably going to be one of those areas.
But the penalties are only getting bigger. For 2015, they'll be up to 2% of your income, or $325. To avoid that legally by getting insured, the deadline is February 15th. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Sticking with the healthcare theme here for a minute, a deal between the state of Indiana and the federal government to expand Medicaid offers a telling glimpse into how flexible the Obama administration is prepared to be to get more people on the healthcare insurance rolls. The agreement reached this week, which could wind up as a model for other states, says those eligible are going to have to pay a monthly premium of at least a dollar. Doesn't sound like much, I know, but that dollar is a big deal for people philosophically opposed to Medicaid expansion at all. It's also a big deal to people whose incomes are staggeringly low. So from a health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more now on the value of a healthcare dollar.
At corner stores, a dollar can buy a pack of gum, an apple, definitely a candy bar. Starting as soon as next month, it can buy some residents in Indiana the best public health coverage under the state's new Medicaid program,
including dental and vision, and they will not have much in the way of co-payments.
Joan Alker is with the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown. If the very poorest people in the state, people earning just a few hundred dollars a month, can't come up with a buck every 4 weeks, they'll still get covered under Medicaid. It'll just probably be more expensive. Higher out-of-pocket costs, no vision, no dental.
You know, when somebody's giving you something that's free, you don't necessarily value it, but when you pay for it, you know, it builds a sense of ownership and pride and empowerment.
Seema Verma designed the new plan for the state. Serious policy people believe the recent slowdown in health spending has to do in part with the fact that consumers are spending more of their own money. That's the goal in Indiana. Personal accountability coupled with incentives to control costs, that's bread and butter for red state governors, says health economist Len Nichols.
There are people who wake up in the morning who feel very differently about a subsidy program that has the recipients pay something as opposed to paying nothing.
Nichols could see Republicans rally around something like this if putting skin in the game saves money. The trouble, says Leonardo Coelho with the National Health Law Program, is that poor people don't have much to give.
It's very hard for many people to understand what $1 can mean to somebody who is low income.
Studies show copays and premiums block people from getting care, including the cheapest kind, preventative. Coelho says if that dollar keeps people out of the doctor's office, that'll only hurt them and cost the state more money down the road. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There's been a lot of talk in high tech, Silicon Valley, really, about how that world is very white and very male, and how some of the biggest names in that industry, some of the biggest companies, are trying to change it. At Facebook, before new hires get a computer or a phone, they spend time with a woman named Maxine Williams. She was hired by Mark Zuckerberg a year and a half ago to be that company's global head of diversity, a job to which she brings a particular background. Williams grew up in Trinidad. She has been a teacher, a lawyer, a human rights activist, an actor, and a television show host. So when we sat down at Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park yesterday, I started by asking her how she was first received at the company.
What I have found was a receptive environment, an environment where people here are very data-driven. So it's about what you bring to them. If you can sell them something that they are willing to buy, they're signed on. And once you make that argument, it becomes very clear to them that this is a logical thing, that yes, unless we do this right, we will not succeed in the way we want to succeed. And once you give it to them, we want success.
Explain, I guess, your concept of diversity in the workplace. It is this thing you have come to call cognitive diversity.
Yes. It's what happens when you boil all of the different characteristics down, when you get down to the why of it. Right. So what it looks like, yes, people from different buckets. But why is because we want to have as many different ways of seeing things, as approaching problems. And that's what you miss when you don't have enough diversity.
Give me the value proposition for a minute. And this is a very base question, but your boss or your boss's boss or however far up the chain Mark Zuckerberg is from you, he is responsible to his board and to his shareholders to maximize their value. When you have your, whatever it is, weekly meeting with him, and he says, so, Maxine, show me the money, what's your answer?
We're leaving talent on the table if we're not doing this, right? If we want the best people, which, I mean, it's not hard to make that a clear case that you want the best people, we're only dealing with a certain segment of the population right now. We are not seeing enough of the others who have been traditionally not represented here. It can't be that at, let's say, 16 to 18% women in tech, that we are getting all of the best people. So the value proposition is almost made, you know, these are smart people. It's not a very difficult leap to see that we're leaving stuff behind, that we need to get more perspectives for the product that we deliver. So it will improve not just what we build, but then how we serve people, because we will understand people better.
You can work until you're blue in the face here, trying to get the staff as it exists today diverse. But if you look at the supply chain, if you will, of the engineers and the human resource managers and the community people, they are still in this line of work overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. So what are you going to do? I mean, that's a pretty big boulder to be pushing uphill.
It is very difficult. So I used to do a lot of improv. And
like theatrical improv?
Sure, improv okay. comedy for Got years it. And years. And the basic principle behind improv is yes and.
Yes and, right.
And I apply that to everything I do in diversity. Yes, we need more now, and we need more then. So we don't just want to be in a situation where we're trading talent between us and our competitors, because that's what's happening now, right? Until yeah. you get more in the system, you're just trading. We have to get the message out there that we want them, and then maybe we'll get more of the market share now. But we also have to invest in pipeline programs. So we have people now whose whole job is to think about how we can contribute to developing the pool for the future.
We had Bob Johnson on the program a number of months ago, founder of Black Entertainment Television, and he puts forth and has for years this idea of the Rooney Rule,
which I'm sure you're familiar with. You're smiling, yes. I don't know if you're a football fan or not, but it's that idea that the NFL now has to interview, owners have to interview minority candidates for head coaching and other senior jobs. Is that a good idea?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I tout the Rooney Rule every opportunity I can get. What the Rooney Rule requires you to do is slow down. In tech, we're going fast, right? Yeah. Everything is so fast. So one of the things that I encourage people to do is to determine, is this really a job you have to fill now? If not, can we spend some more time looking? Because where the Rooney Rule is magic is that it focuses on sourcing. It focuses on the top of the funnel. So what you are allowed to do if you implement it is to keep your bar as high as it always has been. You never have to mess with your bar. All you're doing is seeing more candidates at the beginning of the process so you can keep your process the same, but ensure that by the end of the process, you have had more options. Going too fast may mean that you take the easy route. You go to where you know that quality of talent exists and you don't look beyond your own streetlight, as I say.
There's a non-monetary value to diversity.
Yes.
Right? It's not just about leaving, you know, the best talent on the table. It's the idea of somebody of color walking down the hall and seeing somebody who looks like them. Expound on that a little bit.
I remember I worked somewhere where it was in the days of Blackberries, and the black employees would all say that they would take out their Blackberries anytime they were in the hallway and start doing something on them because they wanted to signal to people that they were professional employees and not the help, yeah. Right? Because there were so few of them who were in the professional capacity that they wanted to signal things to majority people, but then to each other, right? There is a ridiculous amount of value in having more people who look like you because now this place starts to belong to you. You see yourself in the fabric of it. You are now a protagonist in this story, and we all want to be protagonists in our story. So it becomes our story when there are more of us.
Maxine Williams, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
no employees, period, in my Hassless Mattress stores, because self-service stores save you money.
Store of the future or marketing gimmick? I don't know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped 225 points today, 1.3%, finished at 17,416. The NASDAQ up 45 points, nearly 1% there, 4683. The S&P 500 advanced 19 points, again nearly 1%, ended things at 2021. McDonald's, we told you about, up 5% today on the new CEO. E-commerce firm Alibaba clicked down 8.75%. Fourth quarter earnings out today beat expectations, but Chinese regulators issued a scathing report accusing the company of failing to stop fake goods from being sold on its website. Shocking, I know. Continuing slide in oil prices hit some energy companies. ExxonMobil down 0.4%. Chevron dropped 0.2%. Today, bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its advance estimate for fourth quarter gross domestic product. The University of Michigan releases its final January consumer sentiment survey. Andy won an Oscar for his work in Unforgiven and The French Connection. Actor Gene Hackman turns 85. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is going to fall on deaf ears across the greater Northeast. But man, we could really use some snow out here on the West Coast. It is so dry out here because of the drought that ski areas in both California and Oregon have had to suspend operations due to low snowpack. Even trail groomers up in Alaska had to make their own snow so that they could open in time for the holidays. Tom Bonsi has more now on snow as a commodity.
Hey, Boston and New England, Kevin McCarthy wants your snow.
They don't need it in Cape Cod. They need it here in Washington.
McCarthy manages the White Pass ski area in Washington State. The few skiers on his slopes need to look out for ice, rocks, brown patches. The snowpack here is about 25% of normal. Sadly, that's a common predicament up and down the West Coast this winter. For some resorts, it's the second or third tough year in a row.
For 3 weeks, we made snow, and it has been a lifesaver tying the lower mountain with the upper mountain, which has enough natural snow to operate.
McCarthy points out the wide, white ribbons of man-made snow that lead to the base area, but his snowmaking machines aren't a cure-all. They're shut down this week because it's too warm for them to work. Still, McCarthy credits the snow guns for his ability to open on time and stay open.
The last 2 years, yeah, every time we go by these, we want to give them a hug.
Snowmaking systems are not new in the ski industry. Back east and in the Midwest, ski resorts have relied on snowmaking for decades, less so along the West Coast, and that's what's changing.
To remain a viable business, a lot of these places are going to want to investigate snowmaking because it'll stabilize their business.
That's Joe Vanderkellen, who runs the big supplier SMI Snowmakers, based out of Michigan.
A lot of resorts would say, geez, Joe, you're a nice guy, but, you know, we'll never have snowmaking in our mountain because we actually have too much snow. It's interesting to have some of those folks circle back now.
Vanderkellen says resort owners recognize the threat of climate change because they're seeing it. One NASA study says spring now arrives more than 2 weeks earlier in the Lake Tahoe resort region than it did 50 years ago. Vanderkellen says he tells resort operators that snowmaking gives them a chance to weatherproof their business.
There are literally more than 100 resorts in the United States that would have gone out of business without snowmaking systems. It might be closer to 200.
Vanderkellen says his customers may spend as little as $50,000 for a single snow gun and pumping station, all the way up to $50 million at an international resort such as Whistler in British Columbia. I'm Tom Bonsi for Marketplace.
Snow is fundamentally water, right? Just in another form. And that is what we're going to be taking a close look at next week in a series called Water, the High Price of Cheap. To help get us going, we want your pictures of water in your life. Could be anything. Rain, a lake, an irrigation ditch, snow, if you like, wherever water shows up. Put them on Instagram and use the hashtag Waterlog. We'll find them. You know how when you go car shopping, it's not usually a pleasant experience, high-pressure salesmen and all that haggling? Yeah, try mattress shopping. For one thing, it feels kind of gross to lie down on all those worn showroom mattresses, right? Also, salesmen follow your every move, trying to grab that commission on your new firm queen size or fancy pillow top set. A company in Wisconsin says it has taken the hassle out of mattress shopping by taking away the salesmen. From WUWM in Milwaukee, Aaron Toner reports.
It's one of those crazy ideas that just might work. Mattress shopping without the things that make mattress shopping annoying.
I didn't really know that they really didn't have anybody here.
Sue Stefanowski and her 15-year-old daughter, Sydney, are checking out one of Hassleless Mattress's new showrooms near Milwaukee. She keeps expecting salespeople to pop out from back rooms, but none have, and that's just fine.
Because it's not like I have big questions about a mattress. No, this doesn't bother me one bit. This is kind of nice. I'd come back here.
I don't know, I kind of like the squishy.
Yeah.
Super squishy.
As Sydney plops down on a few mattresses, she says she likes that there's no salesperson standing over her.
And then you have to, like, give them your opinion right away, and they're, like, hovering over you waiting. It's really awkward.
And her mom's happy because she thinks this employee-free concept means she's getting a better deal.
A good 13% is kind of what we're actually taking off.
Company owner Weston Huth says his mattresses are cheaper because he doesn't have to pay anyone to sell them. He says the goal of the new venture is to give customers a good deal and a comfortable experience. Huth opens and closes the stores remotely and monitors them using webcams. So how do customers actually buy the products without sales staff or cashiers?
Mostly they go home, kind of think about it a little bit and order from their own computer. They don't talk to me until I'm scheduling the delivery.
Customers can also place orders at an in-store kiosk. And for those who do want help from a human being, Huth has plastered his cell phone number all over the stores and plays this video on a loop.
Because self-service stores save you money. If you have any questions, just give me a call. I'd love to help. In fact, my number's posted right on the wall.
Wally Leacock and his wife did call Huth's number while shopping and got their questions answered right away.
We like looking at things without being bothered or information from salespeople?
Well, it's very experimental.
Mara Devitt is a partner at McMillan Doolittle, a retail consulting firm in Chicago. She says while the concept might work for mattresses, a pretty uncomplicated product, it's probably not something that will catch on for other items, like appliances.
It would be very difficult, I think, to go into a showroom where you didn't have someone who could explain the features and benefits of one over the other.
The hassle-less mattress owners say business is not yet where they hoped it would be. While they're saving on overhead, they're spending a ton on marketing, trying to turn their quirky idea into profits. In Milwaukee, I'm Erin Toner for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we are, as you know, a show about business and economics, so we try to find the money in everything that we do. Occasionally, though, we struggle to find an angle. Take just, for instance, the blizzard of 15 this week. I mean, can you really do a straight-up what's-the-cost-of-snow story? Turns out you can. The controller of the city of New York came out with a post-storm report this morning. Turns out that over the past 10 years, snow and ice removal in New York City have averaged about $1.8 million an inch. So now you know. Tickles me. I got to tell you to find that out. All right. I've been doing this job too long. I don't know. All right. We're out of here. Today, the Dow up 225 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ rose 45 points, about 1%. The S&P 500 advanced itself forward 19 points, again, about 1%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. Thanks today to the staff here at KQED for hooking us up. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. Everybody back in L.A. And this is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.